Today we're going to be talking about the beast, the first beast, and the second beast. If you would please turn to Revelation 17. We're going to be talking about, in our first section, as we talk about the first beast, before we get into the second. We're going to be talking about emperors. So let's do a quick review in terms of New Testament overlap. What is the overlap of the New Testament with Julius Caesar? None. Julius Caesar is dead. But he will be relevant in a minute. Augustus. What significant thing happened during the reign of Augustus? What's that? Right? That's part of how we could theoretically date the birth of Jesus. Augustus was the emperor at that time. Tiberius. Does he ever get mentioned in the New Testament? He does once. I only found once, anyway, in Luke. During his, I think it is how Luke was dating the beginning of John the Baptist's ministry. I think it was the 15th year of Tiberius. So he gets mentioned. Caligula. Does he get mentioned? I couldn't find a mention of Caligula. I looked for Caligula. I looked for Gaius, which was also his name. Claudius. He gets mentioned. You may remember how Claudius gets mentioned? He gets mentioned in Acts. The big famine happens in Claudius' reign. It is also Claudius who kicks the Jews out of Rome, which is related to Priscilla and Aquila, right? So that's Claudius. Nero, I don't believe gets mentioned, but Nero would be, well, by name, unless it's 666. Anyway, Nero, that particular name, that would be the emperor under which Paul was pardoned and then later also executed. Galba, Otho, Vitellius, no mentions. Vespasian, no mention. Titus, no mention. Domitian, no mention. And so this would be, this would essentially be right here, would be where most of the New Testament is already written by the time you get to Vespasian. All right, maybe all of it, depending on when you date, for example, John's letters. So maybe everything by the time you get to Vespasian is just already done in the New Testament. So obviously, they're not going to get mentioned after, right? Now, in terms of Revelation, all right, which emperors are particularly relevant, even though they are perhaps listed here in Revelation? Nero, obviously, he is the beast. Par excellence, he is 666. So Nero, very relevant. Now, how is Vespasian and Titus related to Revelation? Vespasian was tasked, all right, by Nero with the job of destroying, of putting down the Jewish revolt, which ultimately had its high point, didn't end with, but it had its high point in the destruction of Jerusalem. Now, Vespasian did not destroy Jerusalem. Vespasian was already heading west to deal with the revolt that was going on here. Remember, the beast was dying, or at least it appeared to be so. Vespasian was heading west to deal with that revolt and ultimately become emperor, and left Titus to execute the end of the war. All right, and so he would be very much related to what happens in the book of Revelation. He is, in fact, the one who did it. Okay, now Revelation 17. What I told you I would do last time is I would talk to you about how some people take this particular sequence of verses, all right? Not necessarily this is the answer or this is necessarily right, though I think some version of this is right, all right? Just to get you thinking, this is how people, even if there's disagreements, take it. So Revelation 17, you've got the great prostitute and the beast, all right? So the great prostitute, the great harlot, who we've already discussed, I believe is Jerusalem, and the beast. All right, so go to verse 8. Revelation 17, 7. But the angel said to me, "Why do you marvel? I will tell you the mystery of the woman and of the beast with seven heads and 10 horns that carries her. The beast that you saw was and is not and is about to rise from the bottomless pit and go to destruction. And the dwellers on earth whose names have not been written in the book of life from the foundation of the world will marvel to see the beast because it was and is not and is to come. So you've got this twofold statement. It'll get repeated again. All right, the beast that was is not, but is to come. All right, which at first I thought was primarily a, and I don't remember if we discussed this last time, like a mockery on the eternal God, right? It mentions several times in Revelation, who is God? He is the one who was, is, and is to come. Or, seems more likely, more a reference specifically to Jesus, right? Who, in fact, was, but was not, but then rose from the dead and ascended, all right? So you've got essentially either a false trinity here in some way, or a false messiah or something. Because it is intentionally, right, this is intentionally a war against the real Trinity and against the real Messiah. But that particular sequence gets mentioned. Now, when we get to verse 9, all right, this calls for a mind with wisdom, all right? This is the point at which I think we have to go, these heads and the numbers we're going to see are not meant to be purely symbolic. As in, the seven here means something, all right? This is, I think, John's clue to say, well, this is very specific, and I want you to pay attention, because like the number 666, because he, right before he explained, or right before he said that number, right, he did something very similar. So he says here, now this calls for a mind with wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman is seated. They are also seven kings. And at this point, he gives a sequence. Five whom have fallen. One is. The other has not yet come. And when he does come, he must remain only a little while. As for the beast that was and is not, it is an eighth. But it belongs to the seven. And we'll talk about the translations there. And it goes to destruction. And the ten horns, and there's no sequence here, but we'll talk about it. And the ten horns that you saw are ten kings that have not yet received royal power, but they are to receive authority as kings for 1 hour together with the beast. They are of one mind, and they hand over their power and authority to the beast. They will make war on the Lamb, and the Lamb will conquer them. For he is Lord of lords and King of kings, and those with him are called and chosen and faithful. So there's a lot in this passage that is unclear. What is very clear from this passage, all right, the Lamb wins, all right? This is a war, and the Lamb conquers. No matter what they do, they lose, all right? So that part, keep in your mind, is, you know, a huge part of the message of Revelation, all right? Huge and very clear. Now, go back to verse 9. This calls for a mind with wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman is seated. And we discussed that last time. We talked about like the seven hills of Rome, right? Is this a reference to Rome, perhaps? I think so, probably. And there are also seven kings, five of whom have fallen. One is, and another has, and the other has not yet come. And when he does, he must remain only a little while. And the beast that was and is not is an eighth. But it belongs to the seven and goes to destruction. All right, so how do people take this? All right. Five have fallen. One, two, three, four, five. One is six. All right. Now, what you do at this point drastically affects the outcome of what happens next. All right. Now, Nero is going crazy. Galba rebelled. Nero commits suicide. And so you've got the year of four emperors. All right. You've got within, like 2 years, you've got Nero, Galba, Otho, Vitellius, Vespasian. All right? Quick sequence, which you might have in a rebellion as the nation almost dies, or dies, but gets resurrected because Vespasian puts it back together again, however you want to talk about it. So you've got five who have fallen. One is. The next one skips over the usurpers. All right, that gets you to a 7, but there is also an 8th, Titus. Okay. Now, other people won't number it that way. You could also, once again, go with Julius Caesar, 3, 4, 5, 6. See, the one who reigned a very short while, which is true. Galba was very, very short. He would be the 7th, and Otho would potentially be the 8th. Now, Galba and Otho, as far as our story is concerned, are ultimately irrelevant, which I think is one reason to not treat it this way. Another reason to really skip these guys, even though some people don't, right? If you're in the East, all right, if you're in the eastern part of the empire, and there's a whole lot of bad stuff going on in the West, all right? Really crazy stuff. But you are with your general, Vespasian, who ultimately becomes emperor, all right? And there's a civil war. It is actually going to be, I think, very natural. And I know some people in the first century basically looked at these guys as just usurpers, right? Nero is an emperor, and the next real emperor was Vespasian, because these guys were all illegitimate. And this is especially going to be the case for those in the East. The Galba supporters from the West, okay, obviously they're not going to look at it that way. But everybody from the East, I think, is basically going to look at it that way. Nero was crazy, and he died. Vespasian saved the empire. And he did. Okay? This was legions all fighting against each other, military expending its own power. All right? You've got, at that point, barbarians rebelling. It's very, very bad. Vespasian puts it back together, and then it stays together for a few hundred years. Okay? But some people, though, are not going to skip these. Though, personally, I think you need to. Now, another thing to think through is to say, well, why start with Julius Caesar? All right? Was Julius Caesar an emperor? It depends on when you start counting. Suetonius, when he wrote his Lives of the 12 Caesars, he started with Caesar. But some wouldn't. So some would start the sequence here. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and then 8 would be down here. Now, if this is what John's trying to do, then this actually means that the one that is Galba, and John is writing really, really late, like right before AD 70. This is how people take it, all right? Ultimately, your general interpretation of the book does not hinge on this, all right? But it does seem like John is trying to give you a sequence. 5 have fallen, 1 is. All right, and if you're getting the revelation, right? If you're John, and you're getting the revelation, are you going to know who's emperor right now? The answer is yes. You're going to know exactly who's emperor, all right? And so you're going to go, okay, I know where I am in this sequence, all right? And then there's one more, and then there's one more, okay? And so you, as John, think through some sort of sequence like right here, and also as those who read the book, all right, once it's written down, they also think through the sequence. Now, one thing that's interesting about reading through the book and just thinking about the dissemination of a work like this, let's say Revelation was written in AD 69, okay, or AD 68. How much time is there going to be for John to write this down and get this spread amongst the churches? Not long. Now, since he is, historically speaking, generally associated with the churches of Asia Minor, as the lampstands at the beginning of the book, okay, getting a book spread across a province of the Roman Empire or two in a short period of time, quite doable, right? In terms of widespread, that seems highly unlikely. But at least for receiving the revelation, getting it out to those churches in a very short period of time and saying, don't worry, read this book, it's all going to be okay very, very soon, is something that's very possible. So if you go read the commentators, you're going to find this is what they're doing with the sequence. I will let you decide or not decide, all right, how you want to think about the numbering. Yes, Jennifer.
So So the one that must remain a little while, if it's Vespasian, and he was around for a little less than 10 years, does that count as a little while?
That's a good question, right? Now, if you compare him to a Galbanoth or a Vitellius, he was around quite a bit longer than them, all right? If you compare Vespasian to an Augustus, he was around quite a bit shorter than Augustus. And so that's one of the tensions, one of the issues with ultimately putting him as the seven. So do you take the roughly 10-year reign as a little while? I don't know. If you count seven as the other guys, then ultimately Vespasian is the eighth. Now, theologically speaking, all right, and part of this is working backwards. Ultimately, right, as far as the text of Revelation goes, Galba, Otho, Vitellius themselves are not important, except for the role they played in the death of the beast, or the momentary death of the beast. They are not particularly important. Theologically speaking, Nero is hugely important. But the next question you have to ask theologically, all right, is who's more important, Vespasian or Titus? Theologically speaking, I think you can make a much better argument that Titus is the bigger deal. Because Titus is the one who marches into the temple when he destroys the city. Titus is the one who, after he became emperor, all right, within like 2 months, I believe, Vesuvius erupted. The empire is once again thrown into turmoil. He dies a couple years later. He has at that point a very short reign, all right? So theologically speaking, Titus is ripe. In terms of, it makes sense that it would end on him. But is that proof? The answer is no. And going back to the discussion we've had many times, all right, this is following the Old Testament pattern. The people of God sin, all right? God sends them a nation. And then what does God do to that nation? He goes and brings judgment on that nation, all right? This pattern is never broken that I know of in the Old Testament. It is so consistent. If that's the case, then you must have this happen, all right, where you've got who comes and judges the nation? The Romans do. What's the result of that? And as we've discussed, I think Vesuvius is a great result of that. And Titus, very much affected by that. So that's how people take it, often. Now, there's one other approach to take, and then we'll drop it at that, and just we'll leave this really crazy stuff behind for something, the false prophet, which is much more clear. And that is this. Some people, as remember we discussed the beast, right? In the beast in chapter 13, go ahead and turn there. The beast in chapter 13 is a composite beast, right? Why did the beast have seven heads? Because he is the composite of all the beasts of Daniel, right? He even has the physical animal characteristics of the beast, of all the beasts of Daniel. So he is the worst of the beast. And of course, in Daniel, he was in fact also the worst of the beast. And so you've got this beast here. And the beast, all right, each beast represents what in Daniel? They don't represent individual kings or sequences of kings within an empire. The beast and Daniel represent whole nations, right? Babylon, Medo-Persian Empire, Greece, Rome, right? There's your general sequence. If that's the case, then what some people do, and this seems to be at least to me, a more minority opinion, but it's out there, is to not take these heads, all right, these heads of the beast in 17 as emperors at all, but to take them as nations. That it is once again giving you a sequence of nations. The thing that's not convincing to me is I don't know what that sequence would be in terms of five and then a sixth and the seventh. But if you want a good example of that, if you feel like buying a commentary, Beale Beal, this is Greg Beal. He wrote, he's my favorite commentator on Revelation. All right, he's not a preterist, so I don't even agree with him on most of the book. But he's the best commentator. He has fantastic information. He's a he's basically one of those who believes that this is symbolic of all Christian time. Christ is always conquering. The church is always being persecuted. And so the beast, what is the beast? Well, the beast is every single persecuting nation that has attacked the church throughout time. So I don't agree with Beal in terms of his big picture of the book, but he's so good at laying out data, all right, and talking about not only his position but others. And so if I had to tell somebody to get one commentary, that would be it. And he, I think he tends to lean towards this as the, that nations as the heads is the best option. If you want good discussions of this, then Chilton would be good. Or Kenneth Gentry would be good. So anyway, different options there. Just want to discuss them, lay them out. I kind of lean toward this one. Theologically, that makes the most sense. And I think it can be explained. But it's not clear to me. And I wish it was. And when things aren't clear, it's fine. But you just leave them tentative. All right? Any questions about that before we talk about the second beast? Okay, let's look at the second beast. The second beast is actually super clear, all right? It may not be, it's not obvious, but it is clear, all right? Not obvious in the sense of when you read it, oh, this is clearly what this is. But once you put all the pieces together, you go, yes, firm ground. We know exactly what this is. I'm super, super confident on this one, as is others, okay? Revelation chapter 13. The second beast. Now remember, in terms of right the sequence, the dragon. Who is the dragon in chapter 12? Anybody?
Satan.
Dragon is Satan. The first beast, all right, is a mirror image of the dragon. All right, he is his chief representative, his chief worker in the world. And then there is a second beast, all right? And so the second beast, the first beast points towards the dragon. He mimics the dragon, he looks like the dragon. The second beast points towards the first beast. So whatever we come up with, we need to be able to posit some sort of relationship between the second beast and the first beast. And we can totally do that. Then I saw another beast rising out of the earth. This is 13 verse 11. It had two horns like a lamb, and it spoke like a dragon. It exercises all the authority of the first beast in its presence, and makes the earth and its inhabitants worship the first beast, whose mortal wound was healed. It performs great signs, even making fire come down from heaven to earth in front of people. And by the signs that it is allowed to work in the presence of the beast, it deceives those who dwell on the earth, telling them to make an image for the beast that was wounded by the sword and yet lived. And it was allowed to give breath to the image of the beast, so that the image of the beast might even speak and might cause those who would not worship the image of the beast to be slain. Also, it causes all, both small and great, both rich and poor, and both free and slave, to be marked on the right hand or the forehead, so that no one can buy or sell unless he has the mark. That is, the name of the beast or the number of its name. This calls for wisdom, just like Revelation 17. Let the one who has understanding calculate the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man, and his number is 666. Okay, so if we're going to talk about the second beast, there's a few things we need to satisfy if we want to identify who the second beast is. One, he must serve the first beast. Okay? Right? He exercises the authority of the first beast and is pointing everybody to the first beast. Okay? So that has to be a part of our explanation. All right? Now let's talk about the religious nature of this thing, right? I call it the false prophet. Why do I call it the false prophet? We discussed this a few weeks ago. You've got Elijah echoes, all right? Whoever he is, he's calling down fire, all right? Clear reference to Elijah. He's also trying to get people to worship, okay? You've got worship, you've got fire, all right? And so you have this religious element. So whatever it is, it has to serve the first beast. Now, it could explicitly serve the first beast or implicitly serve the first beast. Now, like, for example, if someone worships an idol, they're not necessarily explicitly worshiping Satan. But they really are. But best, and we can come up with this, you need someone who really does actually follow the first beast. And we can come up with that. It's not all that hard. All right, so the next one, he is a religious figure. Okay? The first one is not a religious figure. It doesn't have those images. And another reason why to take this as a religious figure, instead of just going with the images, turn real quick to Revelation 16, 13. We'll start with 12. Because now you see this unholy grouping mentioned. And I saw coming out of the mouth of the dragon and out of the mouth of the beast and out of the mouth of the false prophet. Doesn't call him the second beast. He identifies it at this point as the false prophet. All right. Or if we look at Revelation 19. This is right before the millennium. Revelation 19, verse 19. And I saw the beast and the kings of the earth with their armies gathered to make war against him who was sitting on the horse and against his army. And the beast was captured, as was the false prophet, who in its presence had done the signs by which he deceived those who received the mark of the beast and those who worshipped its image. All right? Quite clear reference back to the chapter 13. You can also look at Revelation 20:10. He is once again called the false prophet. All right? So this is why we look at the second beast and we call him the false prophet. All right? Not only thematically in Revelation chapter 13. All right? Not only that, but also he is later on just shorthand. How do you describe the second beast? Well, instead of saying second beast, just call him false prophet. Okay? So he's clearly a false prophet. And sequencing-wise, all right, sequencing-wise, whatever this is has really got to last, all right, until the point at which the beast himself is judged. So look back to Revelation 19. All right. So when the beast of the earth is ultimately captured, all right, when I saw the earth and the king, the beast and the kings of the earth with their armies gathered to make war against him, this is Revelation 19:19, who was sitting on the horse and against his army, and the beast was captured, and with it the false prophet who was in its presence and had done the signs by which he had deceived those who received the mark of the beast and those who worshipped its image, these two were thrown alive into the lake of fire that burns with sulfur. Okay? So whoever it is, it must in some way last. All right? Must in some way last. Now back to Revelation 13, if you would. Let's say you're in Judea. All right? Let's say you're in Judea. Who is going to be, all right, who is going to be able to control who gets food and who doesn't? Some political force. Now, the emperor is really far away. But you're right. Now, whoever this beast is, where does he get his power? He gets his power from the first beast. He gets his power from Rome. He gets his power from the emperor. All right? And so, you're totally right. This is exactly the way to go. All right? Who's going to control the supply of food? All right? Well, that's going to be a political power. So, this is a political power in some sense. But it's also a religious power, all right? Whatever it is, it has to be able to control, all right, not only religious things and point people towards religious things and have some sort of religious function, but it also must have some sort of political function and authority given to the emperor, but exercised to force people to worship the beast, to force people to worship the emperor. Now the question is, if this is the case, is there, all right, is there something that you can point to in the first century? All right, is there something you can point to in the years leading up to the destruction of Jerusalem that fits this? All right, and the answer is definitely yes, but I don't know if I want to tell you quite yet. Definitely yes. Now, let's back up a little bit, all right, historically speaking. How did, all right, you remember Herod, right? There's several of them. All right, Herod the Great, all right, his father Antipas, and all the various Herods below after him, all right? How did he get his power? Anybody know? He got it from Rome, right? Antipas had dealings with Julius Caesar. Herod the Great had dealings with Augustus, all right? They got their power explicitly, clearly from Rome, right? The Jews didn't go, hey, Herod the Great, come on in, right? Why did they not like Herod the Great?
He's a half-breed.
He's a half-breed. He's an Edomite, all right? Yeah, half-Jew, but Edomite. And in terms of religious, all right, in terms of religious practices, was Herod the Great a good Jew? No. No, he was genuinely terrible. He did not get his power from the people. He got his power quite explicitly, all right, from the beast. Now, that really fits this super well. But what about the religious aspects? Was Herod the Great a super religious guy? Not particularly. Now, he did do a lot of work in the temple. And one thing that's really interesting, all right, you can already see where I'm taking you on this. One thing that's really fascinating about this, all right, is if you think about the priesthood, where does the high priest come from? All right. Now, where he should come from is from the line of Aaron, all right, well, the line of the Levitical tribes, right? That's where he's supposed to come from. And specifically, as we've discussed several months back, he really needs to be of the line of Zadok. Remember that discussion? All right, Zadok being going back to Solomon's time. Do a word search, go find Zadok. All right, Zadok being this guy. He really needs to be a part of that. All right, but what's actually happening during the intertestamental period and during this period of time as well? Who appoints the high priest? The guy who worships the first beast. Okay? The guy who gets his power from the emperor. He puts as a part of the high priesthood whoever he wants to. So the second beast politically controls things because he gets his authority from the first beast, and religiously controls things because he puts whoever he wants in charge of the religious life of the nation. So what does Herod want? What does Herod Antipas want? What do any of these guys want? They want stability, they want security, they want money, they want to maintain their authority, which they lost to a certain degree when Pontius Pilate came in, but you've still got descendants of Herod at that point ruling in various parts, right? We see them in the gospel stories, we see them in Acts a number of times. You've got these guys very much wrapped up in the national life of Rome, right, in the national interest of Rome, but also obviously in their own interest because they want to maintain their power. And so they control the high priesthood, they control, right, the nation, they persecute the nation, all right. They try to get the nation to follow Rome, all right. Remember whenever they crucified Jesus, all right. What do they have to say to Caesar to get Jesus killed?
He's trying to make himself a king.
He's trying to make himself a king, all right? We have no king but Caesar, right? They are And a lot of these would be, all right, the religious leaders, those put in place by the second beast who serves the first beast. We have no king but Caesar, right? Not who's God's king? Who's the nation's king? God is their king, right? The Messiah should be their king, not Caesar. They are quite explicitly at that point saying, we worship Caesar, all right? And so in terms of the line of Herod, all right, it fits all of these. Now, that all is actually fairly clear. One thing we're going to do next week is I'm going to bring you some selections from various pieces of literature that talk about this kind of stuff. You've got, for example, Josephus. We've talked about Josephus quite a bit, right? He wrote a history that covers the Jewish war, which is fantastically useful. He talks a lot about this kind of stuff. Another group, all right, another group. Do you remember what one of the big beefs was? And this comes back to our Zadokite discussion. Remember what one of the big beefs of the Dead Sea Scroll community was? One of their big things was, you know what? Yeah, you've got a priesthood in the temple, but it is a false priesthood because it doesn't follow the Zadokite line. And so therefore they leave. We will not worship at that false temple, all right? Theologically speaking, you know, forget the Dead Sea community, forget the Pharisees and the Sadducees. Theologically speaking, when we think about the rebuilt temple, do we look at the rebuilt temple, all right, and look at that and go, yes, that's God's second temple. God commanded it to be rebuilt, but theologically speaking, did His presence come back into the temple? The presence of God did not enter the second temple, right? Till, and I think this is a big point in the Gospels, the presence of God did not enter the temple until Jesus entered the temple, okay? That's the second temple, the real second temple. And so, theologically speaking, forget the Dead Sea community, we have to look at this, all right, as a corrupt temple and a corrupt system. And that's something that Jesus does all the time in the Gospels. He's looking at these guys and going, you're terrible leadership. You're leading the people away, which is why he's condemning them so often. So Jesus is no different than the Dead Sea community in this respect. And so what do you have? This actually fits like a glove with Revelation. You've got a political system which is controlling the religious life of the nation, which is very vested, completely vested, in the success of the Roman Empire and being viewed by the emperor as a good servant and a good leader. So you don't remove me and don't remove the imperial support that I get, right? All of this, politically speaking, makes a whole lot of sense. Now, there's some other ties to discuss, and that's what we'll do next week. So what I want you to think about between now and then, think about the Gospels presentation, all right, of the Herods. It's never positive, right? Think about that. Think about the priesthood, theologically speaking, on how we should look at the priesthood. But now, the Jesus' disciples, all right, this is something they had to learn, right? When they saw the temple, they were kind of, hey, Jesus, look at those big buildings. And what does Jesus say? I'm going to destroy those big buildings, right? They are also in this trap of this false prophet, right? Jesus pulls them out of this trap by teaching them the truth and saying, I'm going to destroy this temple in the end. So think about the gospel narratives. What this ultimately does, by recognizing all these things and fitting them with a false prophet in Revelation, is it ties Revelation into that same exact story, all right? And fits really well. So next time, I'll bring you some other selections for second temple literature. We'll read from them, get their perspective on all of this. You'll see this isn't a weird thing to think, right? This is actually very defensible, all right? And something that I think helps tremendously in terms of our interpretation of the second beast. So I know that's going to leave a lot of open questions, which we will start trying to answer next week. Any questions at this point about this basic reconstruction of the second beast? Yeah.
sense what you're saying here, but for Revelation 19, where mm-hmm. the beast is getting captured and the prophet there,
mm-hmm.
Are we fast forwarding in time? Or?
So when you get to Revelation 19, right, this is, you know, Revelation 20 is the establishment, right, the real establishment of the millennial kingdom, all right, which as a millennialist, right, we look at that and go, okay, this is not a 1,000-year physical reign of Christ on earth, right? We look at that as, okay, this is the kingdom of God right now, active with Jesus as king enthroned in heaven, which is totally the point of Revelation, Jesus enthroned, right? So ultimately you've got, all right, if ultimately you've got the beast, all right, getting slain in some significant way in AD 70 or around that time, all right? And what you have to do, which is something we'll do next time, is you have to say, all right, how did the false prophet, if this is, all right, if the false prophet is the line of Herod, all right, if it is that family, all right, and the political power that they used and exploited the nation with, then how do you fit that in? And so, yes, from this perspective, it's the future. Not far future, near future. I'll have resources for you next time. Yeah, take home reading material. Teaser. So yeah, so Revelation 19 is a little bit in the future from where we are right now, but not far. Because the beast that is, Nero, is still alive. By the time we get to the death of the line, the Nero will have been dead for a few years. Yeah.
I'm trying to figure out why he said it was the beast out of the sea. It's because Rome is on the Mediterranean from Palestine, but it was the premier naval power in the time.
Yes, it was. I mean, they own the whole Mediterranean. You know, visually, going back to our visual, and this also very much relates to the discussion of the second beast. All right, if we look at a map, if this is the Mediterranean, okay, there's the Mediterranean Sea. Here's the coast. Here's, you know, Palestine, and then you've got Jerusalem in here. Where is John standing when he sees the first beast? He's on the beach. All right, what does he see? He sees beast number one. All right. Beast one, right here, coming out of the sea. Where does he see the other one from? Come from? Beast two, from the land. Okay? So just in terms of thinking about it geographically, all right, what does the sea represent? The sea represents the abyss. The sea also, where their beasts do come from here. The sea represents the abyss. Also in the Old Testament, the sea often represents Gentile nations. What do you have? You have the beast coming from the abyss, the beast, the Gentile nation coming out. But the second beast, the false prophet, is not situated in the Mediterranean. The false prophet is situated on the land. And if the land, if this is where we're talking about, it's quite explicit about where is it coming from. It's coming from Jerusalem. It's coming from the land of Israel, which is, of course, where the Herods were situated.
When the Romans arrived in Jerusalem, they actually landed from the sea.
Vespasian actually came from the north.
Yeah.
Because he attacked, if I remember right from Josephus, he attacked Galilee first, which is in the north. Which, I mean, west is the general direction. Where does the beast come from? He comes from west. I don't believe he landed that way. What's the natural invasion route of Israel? It's from the north. That's kind of the normal way to come. And the Romans would do the same thing. Where are their legions? Well, they've got legions down in Egypt, but they've also got legions over in the Balkans and in Asia Minor. And that's where Vespasian is going to come from and attack Galilee and come from the north. But the beast in Revelation, all right, is, when it says the beast, don't think Vespasian and his army. Vespasian and his army, yes, is a part of the multi-headed beast. The beast is
Rome.
It is the great sea power, like you said. So the beast is before Vespasian. The beast that we're talking about here is pre-Vespasian. Make sense? Okay. I think this false prophet stuff is fascinating. All right? More next time. No final questions? Okay. Michael, will you pray first, please?